this is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. There was a lot happening in Montpelier this week. The Vermont legislature opened its new session with new leaders in both the House and the Senate. Governor Peter Shumlin delivered his farewell address to lawmakers. Vermont's new governor, Phil Scott, outlined his broad policy goals in his inaugural address. And the Vermont Supreme Court blocked Governor Shumlin from making an appointment to the court. Today on Vermont Edition, we've got a group of some of Vermont's best political reporters to discuss these and other issues. With us are Elizabeth Hewitt of VT Digger, Terry Hallenbeck of 7 Days, and April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. What are some of the key issues that you would like to see the 2017 legislature address? Do you think a change in governors will make it more or less likely that these issues will be dealt with? 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Better yet, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Let's start off with this week, chronologically at least, and start with the Vermont Supreme Court. The chamber of the court was packed on Tuesday afternoon. The issue was a challenge to Governor Shumlin's plan to appoint a new justice before he left office. This all happened because Justice John Dooley announced in September that he would not seek another 6-year term on the court. And that meant that Dooley would leave the bench at the beginning of April. But there was a question, is there a vacancy on the court right now if Dooley isn't leaving for 3 months? And it was an important question because it would determine who, Shumlin or incoming Governor Phil Scott, would appoint the next Supreme Court justice. Elizabeth, you were there in the chamber. What was the mood in the chamber, and how did these two sides frame their arguments?
Well, it was a pretty packed chamber. All the seats were filled, and there were folks spilling out into the lobby. A lot of very notable figures in Vermont's legal community, including now former Attorney General Bill Sorrell, and many lawmakers were on hand for it. And it was an interesting argument. It was about an hour. It was an hour long, which is longer than most hearings at the Supreme Court. Representative Don Turner and Senator Joe Benning's legal team, which was Representative Jensen Wilhoit and former Attorney General candidate Deb Bucknum, they argued on this issue of vacancy. They really said that it comes down to a matter of how you define vacancy, and that they did not agree with Shumlin's assessment of the situation. Shumlin's team argued that it's not so much a question of vacancy. They looked to the process, to how the statute triggers the function of the Judicial Nominating Board, this panel of legal professionals and lawmakers who are supposed to be working on appointing folks or on naming a list of potential appointees. And so it was a pretty lively debate.
Did you have any sense there that this is sort of the judicial branch of government making a decision about the executive branch? Any kind of tension there?
You know, it certainly was an interesting. It was interesting to have the legislative branch coming to the judiciary branch to make a decision about the executive branch. So it was sort of one of these moments of constitutional magnitude. And I don't know how much it actually came through in the debate on the day, but
April, you were there.
Yeah, it was interesting to me that Associate Justice Dooley was sitting on the bench while they were all discussing his departure from the court and what should be done to appoint his replacement. That was interesting to me. And it was also kind of, there were some moments of humor throughout the hearing. Obviously, it's a very serious question, but the Supreme Court was very aware that they were listening to arguments about themselves. And so they made some comments like, well, you can't have a sixth justice until Dooley leaves. And don't have enough chairs in the room. And anyway, so it was just kind of an interesting, almost surreal moment in some ways, just to hear them discussing themselves. And obviously, they know the importance of this decision.
Was that an important point? It was. I don't know if it was Justice Reiber who might have said that. Where's the vacancy? I don't see the vacancy on this court. I mean, did that sort of summarize the court's feeling?
Pretty much, because that came through in the decision that was eventually put out. They decided against Governor Shumlin, and that was one of the lines. lines that they said. They said that Governor Shumlin could not swear in the new justice because that would mean that there would be six justices. So that argument was included in the final final ruling on that.
Well, one of the people bringing legal action, as we discussed, was Milton Representative Don Turner. After the court blocked Shumlin on a 5-0 vote, Representative Turner had this reaction.
I'm pleased for Vermont because the future now is clear. I mean, this will not come up again, whether it's a Supreme Court justice or whether it's a Natural Resources Board or a Green Mountain Care Board or a Public Service Board appointment. It's not going to happen again.
Terry, what are your thoughts about this?
Well, this is a rare victory for the Vermont Republicans in the legislature. You know, they're often trying legal or parliamentary maneuvers in the legislature to gain footage, and they just don't have the numbers. And so, boom, Don Turner decides to challenge this, and he wins. Like that, I don't know if that's a sign of things to come or if it was a rare victory, but it was certainly not the way things have gone for them.
And he said it could apply, this decision, to other cases, and he brought up the Green Mountain Care Board, and we do have the situation where the chairperson of the board, Al Gobay, is becoming a member of the Scott administration. So what if Al Gobay had resigned 2 weeks ago? Could have set up the same kind of scenario.
Right. And they're going to have another vacancy on the Green Mountain Care Board. So, yes, that he could have left a different board than Phil Scott will probably create.
Today on the program, we're looking at all the events this week in Montpelier. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Thoughts about the court appointment, the blocking of that. Perhaps there's some issues that you want to see the legislature deal with. Did you hear Governor Scott's inaugural address yesterday? What'd you think of that and some of his budget priorities? Give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Well, on Wednesday, lawmakers returned to the State House for a new session. One of the first orders of business was the election of a new House Speaker. And as expected, Grand Isle Democrat Mitzi Johnson was elected by a 2-1 margin. Here's Speaker Johnson describing some of her challenges.
And we owe Vermonters good, honest, effective state government. That's why I'm asking this House to evaluate state government and prioritize what Vermonters need most so that we may preserve the long-term health and wellness of our state. We're committed to working with the administration to getting this right.
So, Terry, tell us a little bit about Representative Johnson's legislative experience and how that experience might affect her style as House Speaker.
She, you know, has run the Senate Appropriations Committee the last couple of years and has been on it for 10 years. She's a policy kind of wonk, a numbers wonk. She's very deliberative. She's always been talking about finding ways to reorganize state government to make it more efficient, which is a similar point to what the new governor has emphasized. But those are elusive concepts that, you know, so it will be interesting to see if she can pull that off. Those, you know, it's hard to move the boat. It's a big, heavy boat. And so, you know, she didn't make a lot of changes. The committee chairs that were there are still there. She did change some of the rosters beyond the chairs, vice chairs, and members of committees. She reorganized some things, including creating an energy and technology committee instead of energy and natural resources, and shifting some duties around. So she's sort of lived up to her claims for wanting to reorganize government by let's look at the issues of IT and that sort of thing. But I think we will find a very contemplative person in charge.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Tim, who is calling from Barnard. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My comment is in regards to, it's a question, too, in regards to the Act 46 legislation. And if Phil Scott and his administration are going to address possibly changing or repealing it with the legislative body. And my concern mainly is on school closures and the economic impact it's having to go on families that are having to now travel to go to other school consolidations and their districts changing. So it's not the right way. And furthermore, the secondary question is just simply, how is it that our budgets on education keep going in deficit spending when they're basically a fiscal budget that's approved the previous year? How are we overspending, and where's the money going? No one will answer that.
Okay, Tim, we'll see if we can get some answers. This whole issue of Act 46 and how's the legislature going to deal with it. April, do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, sure. So Act 46, of course, a very complex law. I haven't heard personally, and maybe my other reporters here have heard differently, but I haven't heard any word from Governor Scott about a full repeal of Act 46. I've heard him say he has concerns about particular things, including the impact on school choice. And you did hear in his inaugural address yesterday some discussion about how much we're spending on K through 12 education and kind of a suggestion that maybe we can find some savings there and use that savings to help with early education and higher ed. And one of the ways that, you know, one of the reasons Act 46 was passed was that there was this idea that that would be a way to find savings. So I've heard some concerns. I haven't heard an outright repeal discussion.
Terry?
Yeah. I think given this legislature and this governor, we will not see repeal. What they all have talked about are some changes that maybe protect school choice for communities that have it, some more time for districts that are having trouble finding partners, but there will, you know, they're looking to tweak it rather than, and I think in their response to the caller's question of what about the schools that are closing is that they would close anyway because we have dwindling numbers of students and rising costs. So that's been the argument for Act 46 is that this had to be done anyway.
We were talking about the new leadership in the House, also new leadership in the Senate. Chittenden Senator Tim Ash was elected as president of the Senate this week, and he says a key part of his agenda is representing forgotten Vermonters.
The other Vermont is filled with people who have been at best holding the line, but more likely have been losing a little economic ground in the decade past that has benefited some so greatly. Put simply, there is no shortage of legislative work needed to improve the lives of Vermonters. And this will not and cannot be a thumb twiddlers club.
That's quite a line there, Elizabeth. Not a thumb twiddlers club. Any sense of the kinds of issues that Senator Ash wants to see the Senate deal with this year?
Well, he did come out pretty strongly saying that he's hoping that the Senate will take on issues related to poverty and that kind of thing. That was also mirrored in the House a bit. Mitzi Johnson had reshuffled the House General Housing and Military Affairs Committee to put an emphasis on affordable housing there as well. But in the Senate, my understanding is that he's going to be expecting committees to be taking a look at the questions of around poverty. And he also is going to be asking committees to go out into communities and get hold meetings outside of the State House, trying to get perspective from communities to inform their decisions on policies later on in the session.
So we have a new speaker in the House who's a Democrat. We have a new Senate president who is a Democrat slash progressive. And we have a new Republican governor. I'd like to just ask all three of you, do you think they're going to find ways to work together? Or is it inevitable that they are going to clash on some key budget and tax issues? Terry, what do you think?
Both. I think they will work together in a lot of ways. It's in all of their interest to not look like idiots who can't get things done. But they will clash. Right yesterday, Phil Scott said, we have no capacity for new taxes and fees. And Mitzi Johnson said, I don't know how you create a budget without cutting the heck out of things to do that. And I'd like to see what he plans to cut. So they just have different philosophies on that. So there will be some working together and there will be some clashing.
April, what do you think?
Yeah, I think similarly, I think there'll be some clashing over taxes, specifically whether there's going to be any new revenue source for water cleanup. That's something that we heard kind of immediately after Governor Scott's inauguration speech, that he said that he wants to clean up the lake within existing resources. And for some of the lawmakers, that does not seem to make sense in their perspective on how this was going to move forward. So I think that's an area, other areas where there's a need for more money potentially, but Governor Scott wants to use existing resources in the budget.
You know, and I wonder, Elizabeth, if the Democrats decide to quote-unquote reform tax policy, change things, it's not necessarily an increase in rates, but is that another potential area where we might see some disagreement?
Oh, yes, I think probably. I mean, one thing that I think is notable is that you're hearing from both parties similar goals of working towards economic development, towards affordability, and there's a lot of emphasis from both Republicans and Democratic leaders on keeping the budget tight, really trying to have that be a key element here. But that certainly over things like tax policy, where there are these huge differences in approaches, there'll be some skirmishes there.
To end the program, we've got a reporter's roundtable looking at the events in Montpelier this week and how they'll influence the next couple of months down here. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. When we come back, we're going to take a look at some of the policies of the new Scott administration. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today we have a reporter's roundtable looking at the events in Montpelier this week. With us today, Terry Hallenbeck of 7 Days, April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press, and Elizabeth Hewitt of VT Digger. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. You can always email us at vermontedition@vpr.net or just give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Well, yesterday afternoon, Governor Phil Scott delivered his inaugural address to a joint assembly of the legislature, and Scott says the state must develop new and more efficient ways of providing services because of its current fiscal challenges.
Despite modest economic growth, state revenues are flat, and costs are increasing faster than we can pay. Between federal funding, changes, statutory liabilities, and caseload pressures in human services and health care, we face a budget gap of at least $70 million this year. We will uphold our obligations, but we will not fill this gap by raising taxes and fees. Vermonters do not have the capacity to pay more.
So, Elizabeth, is that the major challenge facing the Scott administration? How do you limit budget growth without affecting key services?
Right. I think that probably will be one of the major challenges ahead. And I do think it's worth noting, too, that that's not that different from the struggle that budgeters have had over the last couple years. We've had this structural budget gap. So this is really not a terribly new situation to be going into the legislature with. It will be interesting to see how this new administration decides to tackle this, especially given that there are going to be some big changes in pressures coming up. We've already mentioned the lake cleanup as one of them. There's potentially some changes on the federal funding that the state's going to be getting coming up. We could see a dropout of what comes into the state coffers from Washington. So it could be challenging to continue current services without raising new revenue.
In his address, the governor also mentioned that he'd like to have more resources for both early education and higher education. And he said this could be done by using current education spending levels if the state's K-12 education system is transformed.
I'm challenging our school boards to envision a world where you can focus your time on improving the quality of a school instead of worrying about budgets and tax rates you don't control. I'm challenging our teachers. Think of a world where you're free to teach to the child, not the test. You're promoted on merit instead of seniority, and there is never a cap on what you can earn.
April, a lot of people were scratching their heads after the speech yesterday saying, well, what did he say and what did he mean? And, you know, what are the details and the specifics about all of this? When he says to local school boards, imagine a world where you don't have to worry about budget and taxes. Do you have any idea what he was talking about?
You know, I'm still waiting for a lot of details as well, and it's possible we'll get more when budget time comes around. But, you know, I will say I talked to the president of the Vermont NEA Teachers Union today about that section of the speech. And, you know, she wasn't sure either what he meant. But she did point out, you know, a lot of these decisions about school spending, of course, happen at the local level, happen at school boards. Teacher contracts are at the local level. So if you're talking about changing the way teachers are paid, and kind of this broad transformation, it's not quite clear exactly how that will be implemented, other than maybe through just what we're going through with Act 46 right now that is putting some pressure on the system.
Terry, do you think he's talking about a statewide teacher's contract?
Well, you know, I asked him afterwards what he meant, and he said by the comment that teachers school boards won't have to worry about budgeting, not that he planned to take over the budgeting, which would be huge, but that things will be going so well that they won't have to worry about budgets. So then I asked him, well, how are you going to transform education? Because I think if you use a word as large as transform, that means you got a plan. And I'm not sure that he does have a plan. He said, we're going to work with the legislature and figure this out. Well, maybe he has a plan. He just hasn't rolled out and isn't ready to roll out yet. But he didn't hint at it even then.
Because, Elizabeth, he was talking about putting more money into early education and the importance of early education, I think. And he pointed out that Vermont's support for higher education is one of the lowest in the country. But he's not calling for more overall education spending. Something has to give here, doesn't it?
That was one area of the speech that I was sort of left a little confused as to what exactly was he was planning for his administration to come out of it. So don't have a lot of answers there.
Well, let's go back to our callers and talk to Daniel in Essex Junction. Hey, Daniel, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Well, I haven't heard so far in today's program any mention whatsoever of climate change, and climate change is one of the biggest menaces our state tourism industry faces. If the ski areas don't work, there's an awful lot of hit to the state economy. I have heard Phil Scott promise to veto any attempt to do a carbon tax, which British Columbia has paved the way. We wouldn't be paving the way in terms of the continent, but just within the states. So, Phil, I'd like to know if you'd be willing to call it something other than a tax, but a carbon tax is in fact a tax, and if it's revenue neutral, it doesn't have to behave like a non-revenue neutral tax. But how about some flexibility there, Phil?
Well, Daniel, you know, I think it would be fair to say there are a lot of Democrats who don't support a carbon tax either.
Well, let's have at least put it on the table and look at what's been done and how it's worked in the places where it is being tried or has been tried for quite a while now.
Okay. Terry, what's the likelihood that this legislature is going to vote on a carbon tax?
I don't think it's high. I think they're still trying to figure out how you do that as a single state, and do you put yourself at a disadvantage, and you know, the value of something that's revenue neutral, you know. You know, I think they need to figure out what might work for Vermont. And I just, you know, I do think, though, the caller's point, you know, the governor didn't mention climate change and energy in his address. And there were people who were disappointed by that. Not a huge surprise coming from Phil Scott, but it did leave some people wanting.
And I did speak with Representative Turner, the House Minority Leader, after the speech, and he noted that that was actually a disappointment for him, was that the governor didn't bring up renewable energy siting in his address, and that's something that House Republicans were kind of hoping to hear from him on.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Ralph in Enosburg Falls. Hi, Ralph. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Well, he's always talking about how he's going to protect the most vulnerable in the state. And I'm a disabled logger, and I'm pretty vulnerable health-wise here now. I'm retired, 67 years old. I have blood clot issues, but I take care of myself. I do yoga. I try to walk a mile, do something outside every day. But I just wonder, with all his – he always says he's going to protect the most vulnerable, but with – it sounds to me he's going to have to cut something, and I'm just wondering what he's going to cut. I'm quite worried. I do have the greatest health care I could possibly ever have, and I really appreciate it from the state of Vermont, but I'm worried.
Okay, Ralph. April, this is a big question for the Scott administration, Vermont Health Connect, what to do on the campaign trail. Phil Scott talked about moving to a federal exchange and dumping Vermont Health Connect, the state exchange. But you got all this uncertainty in Washington. Is there even going to be a federal exchange? The answer to Ralph's question in terms of healthcare, is it somewhat of an unknown of what's going to happen here?
Yes, healthcare is a huge unknown. And even in the speech yesterday, healthcare was not its own, you know, huge section of the speech. But he did say, you know, in my budget address, I will be giving you more details about how we're going to keep healthcare, make healthcare affordable and accessible. And so I'm still waiting to hear those. And I think a lot of people are waiting for those details. But it is really difficult, I think, to make a decision when you don't know what Washington is going to do with either the funding for healthcare programs or the very existence of the federal exchange on that issue.
Well, in his speech, Governor Scott also pledged to maintain and perhaps expand the commitment of the Shumlin administration to deal with the state's opiate crisis.
This battle continues to be one of the great challenges of our time. How we react and how we choose to respond to it will be remembered long after our service is ended. It's important that those who fill this chamber in the future and the families whose lives have been forever scarred by addiction know we did everything we could to end it.
Elizabeth, the Shumlin plan was really to move addicts from punishment and incarceration more towards treatment options when possible. Is that going to be a continued approach, do you think, from the Scott administration?
It sounds like the Scott administration is pretty keen to pick up on a lot of what Shumlin built during his time in office. And one of the things that the governor was very clear about in his inaugural address was that he's going to establish this new position, a director of drug abuse prevention. He's going to set up an opioid coordination council, and he's going to hold this state convention on drug abuse prevention. He said that would start this year. Those are positions and initiatives that sound pretty in line with Shumlin's approach of trying to move opiate addiction into the realm of a public health conversation.
We did get this email. Throughout the gubernatorial campaign, Sue Minter supporters consistently raised issues with Phil Scott's plan to keep aggregate state spending growth in line with the growth of wages in the state. The Democratic leadership's current position on the size of state government seems to be in stark contrast to Howard Dean's record of fiscal discipline. Terry, what our Paco would like to know is, do you think the Democratic Party is becoming increasingly aligned with the Progressive Party?
For the most part, yes. They have probably moved farther left than the Howard Dean era of fiscal policy. Sure. And that's going to be a point of contention between them and the administration, no doubt. Like as the other caller mentioned, you know, the governor has said he's going to protect the most vulnerable. The point of contention is going to come down to defining who's most vulnerable.
Let's talk to Jackson, who is calling from Orange. Hey, Jackson, welcome to the program.
Hello. Hello, everyone there. I just have a statement I want to make about the inaugural. I was there yesterday, talked to some of the ex-governors, and the inaugural historically is supposed to be more of a poetic speech of hope and to rally all the troops, per se, in the state house and beyond for ideas and point to directions that the new governor wants to go. I think that you're bearing too much on the speech. The working speech comes next week. The budget speech is the working speech. The inaugural is historically supposed to be more of a poetic thing. And at that, I'll leave you. Thanks. Bye.
Okay, Jackson, thanks very much for your phone call. So, April, the inaugural speech, big picture ideas, the budget speech, down to the details. But Governor Scott did throw out some ideas yesterday, leaving people to think, well, how's he going to do this? Or what exactly does he mean?
Yeah, and, you know, the caller is right. Although, you know, Governor Scott's inaugural speech did outline four policy areas. It was structured around these policy initiatives, including opiates, education, economic development, and fiscal responsibility. And then he immediately went and signed four executive orders, kind of starting to do some of those things. So even in this inaugural speech, I mean, maybe it is poetry, but there was some real concrete policy, maybe just hints at this point, because we don't know all the details, but it was a policy-focused speech in some ways.
Today in the program, we've got a reporter's roundtable looking at the events in Montpelier this week. Your thoughts? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Gordon in Northfield. Hey, Gordon, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Bob. Gordon Bach from CURE Vermont. How's everybody? Governor Shulman talked in his farewell address about how incarceration rates for the state have dropped significantly in his tenure and really in the last decade. However, the number of people we have in the Vermont prison population still exceeds the number of beds in prisons inside Vermont's borders. We still send people to other states and specifically into the clutches of the corrupt private prison industry. And now, of course, there's a quandary because it looks like yet again we have to find another out-of-state private prison to use because of issues with the current contract with the current provider. Would the reporters care to talk a little bit about whether they see a Scott administration continuing the trend toward having, you know, dealing with addicts and people with mental health issues as health issues, not criminal issues, and cutting down the population and possibly eventually leading to the dissolution of any need to send people out of state at all and into the clutches of corrupt private prisons?
Okay, Gordon. Terry, what do you think?
Well, I do think that just, you know, without knowing a lot of details about the Scott administration on this yet, that philosophically he'd be for, you know, keeping the costs down and keeping people out of prison and treating drug addictions as a health problem. I was just talking to Senator Sears, who's going to retain his chairmanship of the Senate Judiciary Committee, about this, and he says coming next week he and the new Attorney General, T.J. Donovan, are going to have a kumbaya moment about this real strong effort to reduce the prison population. And when I asked him, so we're going to end out-of-state prisons, he said we cannot do that yet. That it would, you know, to do it quickly would harm public safety.
Let's talk to Mark, who is calling from Moncton. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi, how's it going?
Great.
So my question, I'm a returning vet from Iraq. And I'm a reservist in Vermont, not in the National Guard. So there's not a lot of programs for us because it's all done federally. So my question is to Phil Scott, what is he going to do in the future for returning vets? You know, I'm currently seeking treatment for the VA that we have up in Burlington. That has been great, but I'm just hoping that they expand on that. We've lost people since we've been back home, and it would just be great for him to, I guess, act on it a little bit more, just like we're acting on with the opiate problem, because we Vermonters are very proud of their National Guard as well as their troops, and I'm sure the Republican Phil Scott and just as a politician in general would want, and a human being want to do a better job about taking care of the vets. So I just wanted your thoughts or comments on that.
Okay, Mark, thanks for calling. Elizabeth, it seems like Governor Scott does have some very close ties with those people serving the state of Vermont and the federal government at this point.
Yes, he did. And he alluded to he took a time in his speech yesterday to recognize vets in the who are in the chamber. And he spoke about his father, who served in World War II, I believe, and passed away when he was a child, and so that came through very strongly in his first speech early on. And I'm not sure exactly if he has any plans to expand treatment for vets in Vermont, but you know, I think it certainly could be on a part of the conversation.
Today in the program, we've got a reporters roundtable looking at the events of this week and how they'll shape the next couple of weeks or months. 1-800-639-2211 is our phone number. When we come back, we're going to take a look at Governor Shumlin's farewell address and the legacy of the Shumlin administration. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today we have a reporters' roundtable looking at the events and the people and issues of the past week in Montpelier. With us, April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press, Terry Hallenbeck of 7 Days, and Elizabeth Hewitt of VT Digger. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. Well, on Wednesday afternoon, Governor Peter Shumlin delivered his farewell address to lawmakers. He talked about how well the state has recovered from the Great Recession in 2011. The unemployment rate was over 6% at that time. Now it's roughly 3%. He did say that his record on health care was mixed. He abandoned his plan for a single-payer system in December of 2014, and Vermont Health Connect, the state's health care exchange, has been plagued with problems since it started in the fall of 2013, although Shumlin says things are much better now. And on the positive side, Shumlin says Vermont's rate of uninsured adults and children is one of the lowest in the country.
On health care, while we didn't accomplish all of our goals, over 25,000 Vermonters who didn't have health insurance when I became governor do now, meaning that they no longer have to worry that one serious illness or accident could send them into bankruptcy. That's where they were living before.
Terry, how do you think health care fits into the whole Shumlin legacy?
I think he's in the long line of people who couldn't pull off a healthcare coup. He tried to tackle something that was pretty big and took down a lot of people before him. But he did expand the number of people who have coverage. Part of that was the Affordable Care Act, but part of that was state government. So I think he will be remembered for the failure part of it, because that's human nature. But there is a success part of it and a drawing attention part of it that he deserves credit for.
And April, other elements of the Shumlin legacy, what do you think if people look back on the Shumlin years, maybe 5 or 10 years from now, aside from health care, what will stand out? Would it be opiates? Would that be part of the legacy as well?
Yeah, I was going to say opiates. And he mentioned that in his speech, that Vermont played a role in bringing attention to that issue. You know, I don't know if opiates will still be a crisis in 5 or 10 years. I hope not. But there definitely is a greater awareness and I would say less stigma around that issue. And as we said, Governor Scott is looking like he's going to continue some of that in his administration as well. One of the things that was interesting to me in Governor Shumlin's farewell address is that he spent a long time talking, not a long time, but a good section of the speech talking about the pharmaceutical industry and the need to fight against them and fight their profits on opiates and opiate treatment. And he called on Vermont to continue that. And I'm not sure what we're going to see of that in the coming years. I'd be interested to see if that is a legacy that continues after Shumlin.
Well, as you mentioned, he did mention it in his speech. The extent of Vermont's opiate problem was really brought front and center when he devoted his entire State of the State address in 2014 to this subject. And he said the goal of the administration was to shift the focus for addicts from punishment and incarceration over to treatment.
The crisis of opiate and heroin addiction did not begin in Vermont, but Vermont began the national conversation about how to do it better. Most importantly, we got rid of the stigma for the disease so that you can hold your head high and head into recovery.
And Elizabeth, he really did put a spotlight on this issue. You know, there were a lot of people afterwards who were somewhat critical of him, saying, you know, why are you telling the world that Vermont has this problem when, in fact, probably most other states had the problem as well? But he really put a spotlight on this and said, we got to deal with this, and we got to deal with it now.
Yes, and he has developed a nationwide reputation, actually, for speaking out on this issue. And I think it will I fully expect it will live on as one of the legacies, the positive legacies of the Shumlin years. And he also did, you know, he followed it up by making some significant structural changes in Vermont as how the state handles folks with substance abuse dependency issues. And I also Governor Scott, in his opening remarks, thanked Shumlin for his service, and he mentioned opiate addiction as one of two things he mentioned about the outgoing governor. He mentioned the opiate, his recognition of the opiate epidemic, as well as his record on Irene, which I think is another big thing from Shumlin that will live on.
Terry, that might have been sort of the high point for the Shumlin administration, do you think? August of 2011?
Right. His response to it was quick and heartfelt, and, you know, he had the appropriate reaction, you know, that sort of the comfort that needed to be said and the moving in and getting things cleaned up. So no question, I think it's his high point.
Now, April, here we are. We're talking about the economy being much better now in 2017 than when Shumlin came into office in 2011. Unemployment rate is half of what it used to be. Mixed record on health care. But he leaves office not a very popular person.
Yeah, and Republicans criticize him for the state budget, which they see as growing unsustainably. Some people on the left will criticize him for the health care, the single payer. Of course, we saw the protests in 2015 at his State of the State. So he kind of gets attacked on both sides at this point. And I think it's just a mixture of a bunch of things. And I think, as Terry said, people do kind of tend to focus on some of the negatives just psychologically as we look back on those years.
Elizabeth, we were talking earlier about Governor Scott saying no tax increases, no fee increases. I hear from some Democrats that they really want to look at property tax reform. And right now, about 70% of Vermont households pay their education taxes based on their income, not the value of their property, in a program known as income sensitivity. And some of the Democrats are saying, hey, let's have everybody pay their taxes for schools based on income, not property. Well, for wealthy people, that probably means more tax burden for them. And the Democrats are talking about using some of that money and lowering tax rates for middle-income people. Is this going to be a friction point with Governor Scott, do you think?
You know, I'll be honest that I don't know a huge amount about that proposal, but that I just suspect philosophically that that's not something that the Scott administration would be that enthusiastic to embrace, and we could see that as a clash.
April, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know specifically about the governor's administration position on that particular plan, which was raised and studied, actually. There was a new report that just came out about that, which kind of gives it some momentum, supported by people like Christopher Pearson, David Zuckerman, Anthony Pulina, people who are more progressive. And so I'm not clear whether there's an appetite for opening up the property tax, whole property tax system at this point. But it is an interesting idea, and I would encourage people to look into that.
And Terry, we were talking about Lake Champlain earlier, too, and the challenges there. I think in the next week or so, Treasurer Beth Pierce is going to have a report that will be a menu of options to say, well, if you want to raise $10 million, you can do it from here. And if you raise this fee, you could raise another $8 million. It's going to be a challenge to provide a fair amount of money to Lake Champlain using existing resources, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that was an immediate reaction to the governor's inaugural address. Was he said he wants to do it with existing resources, especially with the federal government perhaps withdrawing some of their resources. That could be a problem further. So I do think it's clearly going to be a point of friction between the legislature and the governor. This matters a lot to certain legislators. David Dean, you know, came back he wasn't going to run for re-election. He came back to see this one through, and it matters a lot to him.
And April, I'm wondering, in a sort of general sense, we're talking about not knowing what's happening in Washington in terms of health care. We don't really know what's going to happen in terms of the budget. How do Vermont lawmakers make decisions in the next couple of months when there's so much uncertainty in Washington?
Well, they're definitely following very closely any news out of Washington, any indication of what the Trump administration will do or these new leaders who are coming in. And you know, especially in the Senate, Senator Tim Ash has had a big focus on this. And I think that they're just going to kind of move forward as best they can while looking for any hints of what's going to happen from Washington, especially in terms of funding.
It'll be interesting, Elizabeth, to see if they have some sort of contingency plan for the budget to say, well, if this happens, then we'll do this, or if they just hope that there won't be big changes between now and next year.
They certainly when I've spoken with lawmakers about this, they say there are certain areas that they're watching, healthcare obviously being a big one, but some attention on smaller streams of funding. So,
well, it's going to be fascinating to see the details of Governor Scott's budget initiatives. That address will take place on Thursday, January 26th. Many thanks to our great panel today, April McCollum, Elizabeth Hewitt, and Terry Hallenbeck. Thanks very much for being on the program.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sangari, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.